Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.
Indeed Sponsored Jobs gets you quality candidates when you need them most. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
All right, ready to dive into Delphi a bit today. We have a large legal document to go through and share with you in its entirety. But when you hear that, don't think, oh, this is going to be all legalese, because no, there's no way in hell I could sit there and read that. This is Richard Allen's verified reply memorandum to the state of Indiana's response to preserve and produce and request for sanctions. Okay. So basically, all the things that Gull has denied, which is pretty much everything thus far, at least as of this recording, there are still a few things out in the ether, but most things have been just sitting out there or have been completely denied flat out. So this is the reply from Allen's attorneys to all of that. So it starts a little legal easy, but trust me, it does get to more beef of it. And I'm going to try and skim through the areas that are a little too legal easy that don't really pertain to the beef of this as best that we can. But I'm going off of a teleprompter, by the way. So bear with me as we go through this. And please, if you have thoughts on this case, if you have comments, please leave them for us on YouTube or wherever you're getting podcasts. If there's a comment area, please do that. We would love to hear your thoughts on the case. And also press subscribe wherever it is you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of the updates that we have for you right here on the show. I had to put my glasses on because a little dialogue box popped up in the teleprompter asking if I wanted to restart all of our computers right now, because you know how that works. Great timing of Windows. Okay, so here we go. I'm going to work through this. We'll kind of talk a little bit along the way. And again, please do leave your comments and let other folks know about our program here and this case specifically, because there's a lot that needs to be brought to light, and it only is going to happen through y'all's voices. So please make them heard. I think our dog just moved our camera slightly too. and it's still moving. Hey, Belle, we're good with the camera shot right now. Thank you. Thank you for that though. Belle. Come here, Belle. Come here, Belle. Okay, she's over there operating the camera. She's a tiny dog. But if she comes here, I'll hold her up and you can see her. You want to see the dog? You want to see the dog before we jump into this? Okay, let's see the dog. And if you're listening, I'm just going to have to describe the dog to you. So, come here, Belle. Come here. Come here. Here we go. Ta-da. I'm back with a dog. This is our studio dog. This is little Miss Belle. She's a golden doodle. She's a great dog. And good at operating the camera as well as we do this. So there you go. Okay. If you want to see the dog, go to our YouTube channel if you're listening to the podcast. Okay. Here we go. Comes now Richard Allen by counsel and files this reply to the state of Indiana's February 28th, 25 response to Allen's motion to preserve and produce and also request sanctions for the state's violation of Carroll County local rules. County local rules concerning exculpatory evidence in support of said motion. Allen states the following. Here we go. Are we ready? Are we excited? Are we going to jump into this and figure out what the heck is going on? Because I think a lot of us know what's going on, but very few want to admit it. Okay, so here we go. The prosecution's response brief provided proof that the state of Indiana failed to turn exculpatory evidence over to the defense. In his response, the prosecutor glosses over the fact that he was in possession of letters that he failed to turn over to the defense before trial, even though in a February 13th, 2025 email, he denies possessing such letters. McClelland also has no explanation as to why a letter from Davis from October 15th, 2024 is missing and cannot be found. Instead, the prosecution spends the majority of his response denigrating defense counsel. Prosecutor McClelland is not the arbiter of exculpatory evidence or whether he has an obligation to turn it over. The law is the arbiter. Exculpatory evidence is defined as evidence tending to establish a criminal defendant's innocence. Sate versus Durrett, and then the codes on that one. And also citing another one there. Carroll County Local Rule 18B also requires McClelland to turn over exculpatory evidence based upon his February 28th, 2025 filing. We now know that the state of Indiana had certain letters in its possession in October of 2024, but failed to turn those letters over to the defense until February 28th of 25. The prosecution only produced those letters after the defense sought those letters, being forced to file a motion to produce those letters after a prosecution failed to admit being in possession of the letters. The behavior of the state is consistent with a pattern of behavior that has greatly impacted the defense and Richard Allen's constitutional rights throughout the entirety of this case, as will be recounted later in this memorandum. A pattern of withholding exculpatory evidence may lead to a reversal and new trial. Pruitt versus State. This case illustrates what happens when the state engages in a pattern of withholding exculpatory and material evidence, so they're citing that other case, from a defendant prior to the trial. In Pruitt, the Court of Appeals reversed the conviction when soon after the conviction, the defense counsel learned of evidence that the prosecutor failed to turn over to the defense prior to the trial. It's a big deal, because basically if you're just playing catch up here on all this, and I know it is confusing as hell. This trial has so many layers to the onion, so what's what we're here for? We're just going to try and give it to you as easy as we can without holding anything back. Basically, what we learned here in the last couple of months, and they knew for a little while longer, is that an inmate in the jail prison system there had been talking with a possible third-party culprit named Ron Logan, who owned the property where the girls were found dead. He made up an alibi before anybody even knew the girls were dead. Had to make one up. A little weird, huh? Has a very large history of violence. And there's many other things you can look up if you want to look into Ron Logan and questionable behavior. FBI was looking at him as this may be your guy. One of the inmates at the prison said he had a conversation with him and that Ron Logan confessed to him. He was writing letter after letter after letter to the prosecution going, hey, I think this is your guy over here. He has information only the killer should know. And he did. He was talking about a box cutter before that was even public knowledge. And then there's also the connection to Keegan Klein. And the allegation goes that, yes, this prisoner, Rishi Davis, who we'll talk about here in a moment, I had a conversation with him, and he alleges that Keegan also admitted that he had been involved in some way, shape, or form. Keegan, coincidentally, was communicating with one of the girls, catfishing them, and had plans to meet one of them the very day they were murdered. Nothing to see here. That's not questionable. There's no legs to that at all. That's just pure and utter coincidence that local child predator plans on meeting one of these girls that are murdered that very day. And he has nothing to do with it. Pure coincidence. In Delphi, it is, because it's magic land. So again, Keegan's never been charged with anything in this case, but the connection there is stunning. So that's what that is all pointing out right there, that the defense did not get all these letters from the inmate talking about this third-party suspect. You have to reveal that. Why did he not get them? Because McClelland, the prosecutor, said, It's not a big deal. There's nothing to this anyhow. He miserably failed his lie detector test. Who administered it? And by the way, they're not admissible in court. And Rishi Davis also has no bone in the fight. He's not looking to get his sentence reduced. He's not looking for any special perks or anything. And he said that flat out. I don't want anything for this. I'm just trying to give you what I found. So there's that. Continuing on with this, the defense theory at Allen's trial, the defense indicated that the evidence supported that on February 13th of 2017, the victims were abducted, taken somewhere else, perhaps in a vehicle. And then during the early morning hours of February 14th, 2017, after the search parties had left the area, were ultimately transported to the location where they were found on February 14th of 2017. Further, the defense's theory was that evidence strongly supported that multiple people were involved in the abduction and the murder of the victims. The defense theories were detailed in the defense's opening statement and throughout trial or in offers to prove from August 1st of 24, state's theory. The state's theory was that in some order the following events occurred. The killer acting alone after running or briskly walking across a bridge to catch up to the girls, since he was not seen in the 207 photograph anywhere on the bridge, was seen on video walking casually and not panting like a 45-year-old man who had run across the bridge, then abducted two victims, walked, slid down a steep hill with those two victims, then in a panic after observing a van, corralled those victims across an active creek while holding a gun, and then both victims somehow were undressed, but the younger victim was later redressed in the pants, bra, and sweatshirt of the older victim. And the lone panicked killer murdered one victim and then murdered the other victim without anyone hearing any screams, in spite of sound traveling very well throughout that area all the way to the bridge. You know, you're in a valley. Very, very good for sound. And it's the middle of the day and people are out hiking. It was one of those days early in the year where you're like, it's a beautiful day. I got to get out. It's all happened right out in the open, apparently. Nobody took them back to their property or anything like that and cleaned them up, considering that was another big part of this case, because the girls looked clean. Where's the blood? They were slit at the throat. It'd be everywhere. Again, magic happens in Delphi. Continuing on. Then the lone panic killer moved the older victim from one area to another area next to a tree without any drag marks, indicating that he carried her from one place to another. All that activity, according to the state's theory, occurred in a 19-minute time frame between 2:13 p.m. and 2:32 p.m. when the older victim's phone stopped moving, having been placed under a shoe under the younger victim's body. After the murders, the state's theory was that this panicked killer then took time to place sticks on top of the victim's bodies in particular patterns as depicted in photos admitted at trial, and then in spite of his panic, hung around the crime scene for over an hour before exiting the crime scene northward near a cemetery before this panicked killer chose to walk westbound towards his vehicle on 300 North in a bloody outfit, knowing that he would be in full view of any vehicles traveling on that road after having killed the victims in a half an hour earlier. The state's theory was not that multiple men or women were involved in the crimes, but one man alone committed all these acts and did so on the afternoon of February 13th, 2017. Reese Davis letters provide exculpatory information that supports the defense's theory and negates the state's theory, and also provides other information that the defense could have utilized for trial or to support its request for third-party suspect evidence to be admitted into evidence in Davis's letters that the state of Indiana did not turn over to the defense before or during trial. Rishi Davis stated that Keegan Klein, a key suspect in the case, confessed to the murders. A key suspect confessing to the murders is exculpatory evidence. It's exculpatory evidence as it tends to establish a criminal defendant's innocence, ID, at a minimum. Carroll County local rule required McClelland to immediately turn those letters over to the defense. But even if he, McClelland, believed that the letters did not need to be turned over because of Davis's claim that Richard Allen was involved in the crimes alongside Klein and Logan, quote, when police or prosecutors conceal significant exculpatory or impeaching material in the state's prosecution, it is 1 Carroll County Local Rule 18B2. Additionally, McClelland's claim that he was not obligated to turn over the letters because of Davis's claim that Richard Allen was involved is not a judgment call for McClelland to make. Richard Allen was at home on the evening of February 13, 2017, and the morning of February 14, 2017. According to Davis's letters, Klein indicated that Allen was with them during that night and morning, assisting in the murders. It's McClelland's obligation to turn over exculpatory evidence to the defense and let the defense determine how to proceed. Ordinarily incumbent on the state to set the record straight. So the question is not whether the defendant would more likely than not have received a different verdict with the evidence, but rather in its absence, he received a fair trial understood as a verdict worthy of confidence. The jury in Richard Allen's case was out for nearly 4 days, a very lengthy deliberation period. In this case, Keegan Klein's confession to the murders also Klein's claim that Ron Logan was involved are clearly exculpatory statements. Little sip of water there. These were the two most likely suspects during the investigation if it could be shown that they knew each other. That would be a significant fact for the court to consider when determining matters of the third-party suspect defense and also for a jury to consider. The fact that Klein also implicated Allen would not have been of a concern of the defense, as the defense knows that Allen had no linkage to either Klein or Logan, and also because the evidence supported that Allen was with his wife the night of February 13th and the morning of February 14th, when Klein is claiming Allen was with Logan and Klein committing the crimes. Had the defense known of the information contained in the Rishi Davis letters, it would have renewed its motion for third-party suspect defense regarding Klein and Logan and would have further investigated these claims. Perhaps the defense would have sought a continuance to investigate the ties between Logan and Klein. The defense could have argued that Klein or Keegan Klein knew details of the crime that no one else knew, and furthermore, that he, Klein, was protecting an unknown third party by claiming that Allen was the third party after Allen's arrest. The defense could do none of that, as well as any other number of legal, strategic, procedural maneuvering if it, the defense, was in the dark about the contents in the letters while the prosecution was fully aware of that information. The details that Klein provided to Davis and the exculpatory value of these letters, on page 4 of one of the letters, Davis claims that Klein detailed that the girls' bodies were moved 3 times and that they were not killed where they were found. And furthermore, that the bodies were staged. These are facts consistent with the defense's theory and facts that oppose the state's theory. And really just, it lines up with fact of how the bodies were found. Where's the blood? Why did they look cleaned up? Furthermore, in the letter, Davis claims that Keegan Klein detailed how the killers got nervous and left town in their own cars, with at least one of them going to Lafayette to get rid of evidence. It is known that Ron Logan went to Lafayette at some point in time to purchase exotic fish after having asked a relative to assist him, Ron Logan, in creating an alibi. These are all facts that Rishi Davis would not know, but the killer would know. And all those facts tend to establish Richard Allen is innocent. ID. In the second letter, Davis claims that back in 2018, he, Davis, reportedly that the victim's throats were sliced. This is something that only the killer would know, especially when the details of the murders were not known at that time. He also stated that he reported that the girls were hidden in a barn and also driven around at some point in time. This is consistent with the defense theory that the girls were driven in a car at some point and held somewhere until the search parties had left the area, and inconsistent with the prosecution's theory. On page 3 of that letter, Rishi reported that Keegan Klein told him that the scene was staged. It furthermore mentioned that the girls could not be moved because the search parties were everywhere throughout the night at that time, meaning the girls were moved to the place they were found only after the search party left the area. This is just as the defense claimed, thereby supporting the defense theory and negating the state's theory. In his February 12, 2025 interview at Newcastle Prison, Ricky Davis provided further details that he, Davis, claimed believed that he also provided to the prosecution concerning details that Keegan Klein stated to Davis. In that interview, for example, Ricky Davis claimed that Keegan Klein stated that the girls were handcuffed to each other. After the meeting, defense counsel Auger, Baldwin, and investigator Matt Hoffman viewed the crime scene and autopsy photos to determine whether there were any indicators on the victims' wrists that would support this new information that the victims were handcuffed to one another. The admittedly non-expert eyeballs of the attorneys and investigator observed straight lines on the left hand of the wrists of both girls, which, if true, could indicate that one victim walked immediately behind the other with each of their left hands handcuffed to each other so that they could not easily run away. If the defense had received these letters, it could have learned that these facts from Davis during a deposition, if they weren't contained in the letters, and then had experts view the same photos to determine whether the photos were indicative of the girls being handcuffed. Had the defense known of the Keegan Klein statements to Ricky Davis, it could have brought both Keegan Klein and Ricky Davis in for a deposition after hours or during the weekend while the trial was occurring. These depositions could have revealed additional information, including whether at some point in time Keegan Klein finally admitted that Richard Allen had nothing to do with the crimes, as Ricky Davis stated to counsel during a jail interview on February 12th of 2025, and also show that Keegan Klein's claim about the activities on the third person involved in with him, Klein, and Logan was inconsistent with Richard Allen's whereabouts the night of February 13th. And the morning of February 14th. The defense likely would have called upon Kathy Allen to show that Richard Allen was at home during that time frame and not with Logan and Keegan Klein. Additionally, the defense could have asked the Department of Corrections to provide video from the very pod where Ricky Davis and Keegan Klein were housed to determine whether Klein and Davis were frequently talking with another, as Klein has apparently stated in State's Exhibit 4 that Klein has only talked to Davis maybe two times. If the video shows that Davis and Klein talked to each other well beyond two times, then it could be determined that Klein was lying. Whereas if the video shows that Davis only talked to Klein about two times, then it would show that Davis was lying. Either way, the defense has a right to those letters to conduct its own investigation concerning the veracity of the contents of those letters. McClelland's claim that he did not turn over the Davis letters because he, McClelland, made his own determination that the letters were not in fact exculpatory denied Allen and his attorneys the opportunity to conduct its own investigation from the information contained in those letters and to determine what to do, if anything, concerning the content of those letters. In his February 28, 2025 response, McClelland makes much noise about attorney Baldwin attempting to put into the public domain information through the filing before verifying that information. It should be noted that attorney Baldwin first attempted to work the matter out with McClelland via email before filing his motion. On February 12, 2025, Baldwin had emailed McClelland asking for the Ricky Davis letters. On February 13th, 2025, at 2:41 p.m., McClelland responds as follows. The information that we have concerning Ricky Davis was forwarded to you as part of discovery. You had every opportunity to call Mr. Davis at trial or at the hearing on third-party motive. You chose not to. Your strategy was not to call those people. The trial is now over. Richard Allen was convicted. If you feel you need to file additional motions, then file them. The state will respond appropriately. The state will follow any orders the court puts out in regards to those motions. Emphasis added here. Before filing any motions, Attorney Baldwin made one more attempt to simply obtain the letters. The defense responded at 3:54 p.m. on February 13, 25, by asking McLeland whether he was admitting or denying that he, McLeland, had received letters from Rishi Davis in the months leading up to the 2024 trial. McLeland could have quickly answered the question and then provided the letters to the defense and perhaps avoid any more filings. McLeland also could have asked Baldwin to hold off on filing anything while he, McLeland, gathered the letters to turn them over to the defense. Instead, McLeland chose to ignore the defense's request, prompting the defense to file its February 14, 2025 motion to preserve and produce the Rishi Davis letter. It should be noted that the defense was seemingly up against a deadline of sorts. If the defense waited to file their motion, the judge might rule on the motion to correct errors beforehand, which arguably would prevent the defense the ability to file the motion to preserve and produce, as such a ruling would arguably kick the case to the appellate lawyers. Also, note that in his February 13th email response, McLeland claimed to have provided the defense all the Rishi Davis letters during discovery. This was simply an untrue and misleading statement typed on his computer and sent to the defense by McLeland. Through his February 28, 2025 filing, this court learned that McLeland actually was in possession of these letters on February 13th and 25, which contradicted McLeland's representation to the defense that had everything been turned over. McLeland chose to intentionally mislead defense counsel about his, McLeland's, possession of those letters. McLeland was getting called out by the defense once again. And once again, he was ultimately forced to turn over the letters, perhaps out of fear that the defense would eventually gather doc records that would then expose McLeland's misrepresentation. McLeland's misrepresentation has yet to be explained by McLeland to the court or anyone else. And the letters McLeland finally provided to the defense, truly, the only letters, once again, is referring to the other times that McLeland was forced to turn over items after being called out by the defense, as detailed in the next section of this memo. Allen and the defense are not conceding that the doc records that McLeland admitted as exhibits are proof positive that other letters don't exist. The defense has no idea as to how records are kept or how accurate those records might actually be. The defense also is not sure how McLeland was so quickly able to access those records from Newcastle. Certainly, as detailed above, McLeland's response to the motion to correct errors, in which McLeland provides details found nowhere in the Rishi Davis letters, provides a compelling argument for the belief that either other letters exist or video exists that has not been turned over, and or videos in his possession. McLeland's recent response to the defense's motion to correct error provides troubling statements that cast doubt on McLeland's claim that these are the only letters or evidence that are in the prosecutor's possession. In the prosecution's response to the defense's motion to correct errors in an apparent attempt to discredit Rishi Davis, McLeland claims that he, McLeland, had information that Rishi Davis had claimed that Ron Logan took batteries out of Libby's phone. This is curious because the prosecution has failed to produce any document or videotape in which Rishi Davis makes such a claim. The defense has found nothing. This leads to more serious questions of where did McLeland learn this information? The defense is left with one of two possibilities. McLeland has additional Rishi Davis letters, reports, or video from where he, McLeland, gathered that information, or two, for reasons that are unknown, McLeland made up the story. It seems unlikely that such a specific story would be made up, leaving the defense to conclude that McLeland has additional Rishi Davis letters, reports, or video, but has not turned it over to the defense. McLeland has not explained to this court nor anyone else from where McLeland claims he learned this information about the batteries, nor did McLeland back up his story about the batteries with an exhibit attached to the filing. Also note that in that email that McLeland requested attorney Baldwin to file something, which Baldwin did only to have McClellan then cast aspersions about the filing. McClellan's history of holding onto exculpatory evidence until being forced to or called out by the defense, unfortunately, as has been the historical pattern of the prosecution, McClellan made the decision to hold on to those letters until called out by the defense, much like he made the decision to hold on to other exculpatory evidence over the course of the case. Again, Indiana courts of appeal have commented on patterns of withholding exculpatory evidence and have even reversed convictions when prosecutors have exhibited such patterns. Pruitt at 397. 1. Steve Mullins' claim that the Brad Holder and Patrick Westfall and other crucial early interviews between 2/14/17 and 2/20/17 were recorded over. Yes. Crucial interviews. Recorded over. But nothing to see here, guys. It's no big deal. That was not relayed to the defense until January 30th of 24. In spite of the defense asking for that evidence since August 10th of 23. As anyone in the criminal justice system knows, often the most important interviews are those interviews closest in time to the crime. Brad Holder and Patrick Westfall were on law enforcement's radar as suspects very early on in the case, a fact that's evident from reviewing emails all the way up to the chain of to Doug Carter in the early days of the investigation. Those emails were admitted as evidence during the July 30th through August 1st, 2024 hearings. Because of law enforcement's very early interest in Brad Holder and Patrick Westfall, each were quickly found and then quickly interviewed on February 17th of 2017, within 3 days of the murders. On August 10th of 23, the defense first unveiled to the prosecution that the defense, believed that the state's own evidence supported that Holder and Westfall were involved in the murders. From a single two-page document found among hundreds of thousands of documents, the defense found evidence that law enforcement had interviewed Holder and Westfall on February 17th of 2017, and that both interviews were memorialized through audio and videotape. It was after the August 10th, 2023 deposition of Jerry Holman that the defense began demanding those interviews, which the prosecution should have already provided to the defense. When McClellan and Mullen failed to turn over those interviews or explain what had happened to those interviews, the defense called out the prosecution in the Franks memo filed on September 18th of 2023. Footnote on 66 on page 56 of the memorandum details that the prosecution had failed to turn over the Holder and Westfall interviews that the defense had been seeking. Even after the Franks memo was filed and the defense already alerted the court calling out the prosecution for not turning over the Holder and Westfall interviews, the prosecution still refused to answer the very simple question posed by the defense of where is the Holder and Westfall videos? Please turn them over. And the defense, they heard crickets. Instead of immediately alerting the defense on August 10th, 2023, that those videos had been taped over, convenient, right? McClellan and Mullen said nothing. That seems to have happened recently, too. What do we do here? Finally, on January 30th of 24, the prosecution provided a document that detailed some of the contents on certain hard drives that had turned over to the defense. In the fine print on page 5 of this document, the defense finally learned what McClellan and Mullen were claiming happened to those crucial interviews. They were recorded over. I was taping my soaps that day. I had to get Young and the Restless. Along with all the other crucial interviews between 2/14/17 and 2/20/17. Gone. Neither McClellan nor Mullins called the defense and said, we should have told you this when you first got on the case, or at least back in August of 23, but those interviews you've been seeking out for at least 5 months are taped over in 2017. Sorry, dude. Defense counsel has practiced for over 30 years. During that time, if the prosecution in any other county ever received exculpatory evidence or learned that certain evidence had been destroyed, it would immediately contact the defense and tell them on a phone or in person that the evidence had been destroyed. In this case, the defense was lucky to even notice Mullen and McClelland's claim that the crucial video was taped over, as such information was sandwiched between other minute details contained in the document and minutia. This should also not be overlooked. In the fact those crucial videotaped interviews were actually taped over, that would be colossal news that Mullen and McClelland would not have forgotten. Losing that type of evidence would be the talk of the unified command due to the serious nature and potential serious consequences of losing such important evidence. To lose such crucial evidence early on in the case would not be the type of thing that would ever leave the memory of the man in charge of that evidence, Steve Mullen, nor the minds of those in unified command. Therefore, when the defense requested the prosecution to turn over those interviews, Mullen and McClelland should have immediately said to themselves, oh no, those interviews were erased back in 2017. I need to immediately tell the defense. I should have told them that when they got on the case, but I'll do it now. It is inexplicable that Mullen and McClelland would not have remembered in August of 23 when the defense first requested those interviews, that those interviews had purportedly been recorded over. Yet neither McClelland nor Mullen told the defense of this earth-shattering type of news that Mullen had known for 6 years at the time. To make matters worse for Mullen and McClelland, when the defense finally learned of the so-called recorded over interviews, the defense asked if there were some sort of documentation memorializing what exactly happened to those interviews, how it had happened that crucial evidence had been recorded over. Surely a report existed that would explain this terrible accident that caused crucial evidence to be forever lost. However, no such report had yet been tendered to the defense. Some point to the time ladder, the defense finally received such a report. It was drafted by Steve Mullen. Inexplicably, it was undated. Therefore, no one knows if the report was drafted in 2017 or sometime in 24 or anywhere in between. That document was entered as an exhibit, the March 18th, 24 motion to dismiss. This undated document is not normal, nor the normal way that law enforcement and prosecution operate. The question must be asked, therefore, why did Mullen and McClelland not immediately alert the defense that Holder and Westfall and many other interviews were recorded over? When the defense first asked McClelland and Mullen for the interviews in August of 23? And why did Mullen and McClelland not turn over the undated document purportedly explaining how the interviews were recorded over until after the defense questioned that document? The defense has not seen anything other than an outdated document and the words of McClelland and Mullen that support that the interviews were actually recorded over. This is not normal and is very troubling. Neither McClelland nor Mullen nor anyone else in unified command has ever explained to this court, nor anyone else, why they do not immediately alert the defense that crucial evidence sought by the defense had been purportedly recorded over. Neither McClelland nor Mullen nor anyone else has ever explained to this court, nor anyone else, why it took 5 months before providing a document detailing the claim that Mullen, what happened to those interviews. Those are 5 valuable months during which Richard Allen's counsel could have been investigating the actual claim that those interviews were recorded over. This is not normal. For over 4 months, McClelland held on to exculpatory evidence that he had in his possession from Todd Click's lawyer, including a certified letter detailing how a law officer, a law enforcement officer, was concerned, essentially, that McClellan may have the wrong man charged based upon evidence that he, Click, and two other law enforcement officers had gathered over a lengthy investigation that led them to believe that Holder and Fields and perhaps others were involved in the murders. As this court knows from the Franks memo, including documentation provided to the court in that memo on May 1st of 23, McClellan received, through the United States Postal Service, a certified mailing from attorney Paul Varda that detailed why his client, Todd Click, was concerned that McClellan did not have all the information necessary before making an arrest. This certified mailing not only contained a letter, but also the actual evidence that Click and law enforcement officers Kevin Murphy and Greg Ferency had gathered during their investigation. It included several videos that the prosecution had never turned over to the defense from the likes of Elvis Fields, Rod Abrams, Ned Smith, and Johnny Messer. Again, in a normal world, this would be an earth-shattering mailing to receive if you are a prosecutor. Normally, this mailing would cause a normal prosecutor to immediately contact the defense lawyers by phone to alert them that the prosecutor has received this information that clearly was exculpatory. However, that did not happen. Instead, the prosecutor held onto the contents of that certified mailing for over 4 months. The prosecutor only turned those documents over to the defense after it became clear that they, the defense, would soon be learning of that certified mailing. In the August 10th of 23 deposition of Jerry Holman, the defense provided Holman and the prosecution with a 12-page Odin report, where the prosecution had to know that Click was a member of that investigation trio of law enforcement, along with Kevin Murphy and Greg Ferency. McClellan had to have understood that it was only a matter of time before the defense would learn from Click himself that he, Click, through his lawyer, had mailed a letter, much like the Rishi Davis, to the prosecutor with exculpatory evidence. McClellan's failure to immediately turn over this exculpatory evidence has never been explained to this court or anyone else. Why did it take McClellan over 4 months to turn over this evidence? Similarly, it took McClellan approximately 4 months to turn over the Rishi Davis letters. Delayed discovery of exculpatory evidence without explanation is not normal, but has been a constant, consistent pattern in this case. Why, in a September 6, 2023 email to the defense, did McClellan claim that the Purdue professor's identity was known and perhaps would never be known, when in fact law enforcement had known the identity of the Purdue professor since mid-August of 2023? It's not before then? And why did the defense only learn of the Purdue professor's identity after the Franks memo was filed, calling out the prosecution for absurdity and claiming that they may not be able to learn his identity? And yet another example of what appears to be an attempt to conceal exculpatory evidence? McClellan has yet to explain to this court or anyone else why he sent an email to the defense on September 6th of 23, claiming that he and law enforcement did not yet know the identity of the Purdue professor. And more curiously, that they may never learn of the Purdue professor's identity. The Franks memo was filed on September 18th of 2023. Coincidentally, the very next day, lo and behold, Jerry Holman actually found and interviewed the missing Purdue professor, Jeffrey Turco. Only 13 days earlier, it was thought that his identity may never be known. According to McClellan, but after the Franks memo, where the missing professor was discussed, he was found almost immediately. Good going, Sherlock. Let there be no doubt. The Purdue professor's report and even his October 19th, 2023 interview revealed the murders may have left behind sticks in the forms of ruins, consistent with the defense's theory. This is called exculpatory evidence. Well, Turco admitted in his report from 2017 that he could not confirm what the sticks represented. He also stated the argument that these markings constitute a inscription inspired by Norse runes or modern recreations thereof is quite plausible. These words from Turco were not buried deep in the report, but rather in the very first paragraph. It would not be surprising if Holman or McClelland would want the defense to not have access to the report, as that report supported the defense's theory that Norse paganism left the sticks behind, or paganists left the sticks behind, in the form of ruins. In a September 19, 2023 interview with Holman, Turco commented, "I think the idea that somebody is trying to kind of replicate, you know, early Germanic, you know, ruin script, that seems, I think, you know, a given. Both the report and Turco's own words in his interview stray far from what Holman represented in August of 2023 in this deposition on the 10th. As to what the Purdue professor's words were, Holman claimed under oath that the Purdue professor had stated that the sticks were not Odinism or any type of cult worshiping or any type of group that would have conducted the crime. Holman, simply put, misrepresented under oath the findings of the Purdue professor, who never said that the sticks were not representative of Odinism. Not at all. Remember, the same guy? We may never know who he is. Oh, we know who he is. Rather, the words the Purdue professor used was quite the possibility being the exact opposite. Quite plausible was the term used. And it was a given. Yeah. Holman's misrepresentation under oath is very troubling, and he has never explained himself to this court or anyone. The defense believes that evidence supports that McClelland did not want the defense to learn the name of the Purdue professor, and thus, in September 6 of 23 email that he, McClelland, has yet to explain, Turco's report and interview supported the defense theory that Odin and Norse paganism, or paganists, were the murderers that left behind the ruins at the crime scene. After Holman's September 19, 2023 interview of Turco, Holman prepared a report dated, because reports are normally dated, September 22nd, 2023, in which Holman admitted that he had known of the likely identity of the Purdue professor since mid-August 23. If this is the case, again, why did McClelland not disclose this information to the defense instead of claiming to be, to the defense on September 6th of 23 that the identity was unknown and they may never be known? What a weird statement to make in a document like this. "And it may never be known." As he like whips a cape on. It's just utterly troubling. Again, McClelland has never answered that question to this court or anyone else, to the defense, to, it appears, as yet, another example of McClelland's attempts to conceal exculpatory evidence from the defense. Much like the Rishi Davis letters, and it is not normal. Why did McClelland fail to turn over the faked crime scene photo found on Holder's Facebook page even to this day? Yeah. On Holder's Facebook page. Played with sticks, basically, and made it look like the crime scene. Nothing to see here, though. And why did Trooper Roland Purdy twice swear under oath that the faked crime scene image was found on Brad Holder's Facebook page before the murders, only to then change his story on August 1st of 24 at the hearing on third-party suspect evidence? As has been noted in the Franks memo and at various other times, the defense found among the massive amount of evidence a report from Tripper Ryan Winters detailing evidence that suspect Brad Holder had an image on his social media pages that depicted two girls mimicking the very crime scene that law enforcement found on February 14th of 2017. Normal, right? This image depicted two young girls lying on the forest floor with sticks and branches on them, with one of the young girl's arms posed identically to that of Liberty German. This bizarre image had existed on Brad Holder's Facebook page before the murders, according to Trooper Ronald Purdy. Again, nothing to see here. Why would Brad Holder
an early suspect have such an eerily similar image on his Facebook page? Why would anyone have it on their Facebook page, really? But more specifically, him. Unfortunately, the prosecution failed to produce that exculpatory piece of evidence. Of course, the defense had to drive to Georgia to obtain that image from the very man, Ryan Brucher, who had located the image on Brad Holder's social media pages. Trooper Purdy, then under oath at his deposition in the fall of 23, confirmed that the image was in fact on Brad Holder's Facebook page, but that he, Purdy, did not find the image compelling because it had been on Holder's Facebook page for a few years. On July 30th of 24, Purdy once again confirmed under oath that this eerily similar faked crime image was found on Brad Holder's Facebook page. Then very curiously, just 2 days later, Trooper Purdy recanted his two previous sworn statements, now claiming that he could not confirm that the image was on Brad Holder's Facebook page. Additionally, Trooper Winters claimed that in his deposition that Indiana State Police, ISP, could not locate the faked crime scene image that one time was in the possession of the ISP post in Lafayette. To this day, the prosecution has failed to turn over said image. This is not normal. It is also not normal for a seasoned state trooper like Ronald Purdy to retract two prior sworn statements during a hearing in which the mimic crime scene image was a central piece of the defense's argument to allow third-party suspects' evidence at trial. The video of Brad Holder in Westfall, in pagan ritual in Fort Wayne. The defense was fortunate enough to locate among hundreds of thousands of documents a two-page email from Greg Ferency to Tony Liggett, dated December 12, 2018, in which Ferency describes a strange video that Brad Holder took of a pagan ritual in Fort Wayne, Indiana. In the video, Brad Holder was tape recording various people in a ceremony, periodically yelling out things such as, "Hail Thor." At the very end of the video, Brad Holder tape recorded Patrick Westfall standing next to a tree and using his hand to seemingly mark something on the tree. In the email, Ferency commented to Liggett about Patrick Westfall making the tree with his hand, or marking the tree with his hand. This is significant. Of the F found marked on the tree in one of the victim's blood. Law enforcement had believed that the tree was marked possibly by someone practicing Norse paganism or Odinism, and here you go, on video. The defense did not get a copy of this exculpatory video. Rather, it had to ask the prosecution for that video. Eventually, the video was turned over to the defense. It's not normal for the defense to continually have to request the prosecution to turn over exculpatory evidence of an exculpatory nature that the prosecution has in its possession. Normally, the prosecution turns over that evidence immediately without any need to request it. This was yet another example of the state of Indiana holding on to exculpatory evidence before being forced to turn it over. Conclusion and request. What has happened throughout this case is not normal. Prosecutors not turning over exculpatory evidence to the defense is not normal. Prosecutors holding on to exculpatory evidence until being forced to provide it to the defense. This video, but discussed in this video, in the Franks memo on page 67, complaints are there from the defense is not normal. I'm reading this verbatim, by the way. I'm just kind of trying to figure that paragraph out. Prosecutors claiming that they can't locate a key exculpatory witness identity, a witness, mind you, that purportedly altered the way that the case was investigated is not normal. Later, learning that the prosecutor had knowledge of the witness's identity in spite of an email sent to the defense claiming that he may never learn the witness's identity is not normal. The prosecution having no explanation for not providing exculpatory evidence to the defense is not normal. Having no explanation why a report that attempted to explain why key evidence is forever lost was not dated is not normal. Having a seasoned law enforcement officer recant two prior sworn statements concerning a key piece of exculpatory evidence that the ISP claims is or it cannot locate is not normal. And finally, having a prosecutor claim that an email that he provided All the Rishi Davis letters to the defense before trial, when just 14 days later, he was forced to admit that what he, McClellan, represented as truth in his email was in fact not true. That is not normal. Nor is it normal that one of the letters can't even be located, and that the prosecution has no explanation for the missing Rishi Davis letter. It does not matter whether the contents of those letters can be questioned as unreliable. That is not the prosecutor for him to determine. The prosecutor's only determination is to turn that evidence over to the defense. The defense should have had the opportunity to determine the value of that information contained in the letters. It does not matter whether those other defense theories, as the defense has a constitutional right to possess all exculpatory evidence and then to determine how it should proceed strategically in the defense of their client. A local Carroll County rule also requires turning over said evidence. The fact is that the prosecution had in its possession letters in which a key suspect, Keegan Klein, purportedly confessed to the crimes and provided details that only the killer might know, and that information should have been provided to the defense. Because of the prosecution's failure to produce those letters, and because the prosecution has a history and pattern of not turning over exculpatory evidence, Richard Allen deserves another trial. Richard Allen, through his counsel, therefore asks a hearing in which the prosecutor is requested to explain why he failed to turn over the Rishi Davis letters, why he misrepresented his possession of those letters to defense counsel in his February 13th, 2025 email, as well as to explain the other examples of failing to turn over exculpatory evidence as recited herein, which show a pattern of such conduct. The defense seeks such a hearing in order to, one, use the state of Indiana's answers to these questions in a renewed motion for a new trial based upon newly discovered evidence, and to, two, in order to use the state of Indiana's answers to those questions as a record that can be utilized by the appellate lawyers should this court deny Allen his request for a new trial. Lastly, Allen asks this court to order sanctions against the state of Indiana for violating the Carroll County local rule concerning exculpatory evidence. The sanction the defense is seeking is ordering a new trial. There you go. That is that whole document. Right there, front to back. It's a lot in there, a lot to digest. Give me what you think in the comments on YouTube. If you're listening to our podcast, go check out our YouTube channel too and get into the conversation there. Thank you so much if you're watching and supporting. We do greatly, greatly appreciate that. We couldn't do that without you. So let your friends know that we exist. We, of course, are going to keep covering this case because it's not solved yet. Again, Richard Allen's verified reply memorandum to the state of Indiana's response to preserve and produce and request for sanctions. That's exactly what you just heard there. All right, can't wait to hear your guys' responses, and I'll be in there in the comments as well. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Be sure to press subscribe.
Want true crime coverage all day, every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today, and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed. He was charming, handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair, the insurance policy, the other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, she could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, She's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.